The Boy on the Shed is a story of love and fate. At 16, Paul Ferris becomes Newcastle United's youngest ever first-team player. Like many a tricky winger from Northern Ireland, he's hailed as the new George Best. As a player and later a physio and member of the Magpies managerial team, Paul's career acquaints him with not only Kevin Keegan, Kenny Dalglish and Bobby Robson, Ruud Gullit, Paul Gascoigne and Alan Shearer, but also with injury, insecurity and disappointment. Yet the book The Boy on the Shed is much more than a tale about the vagaries of sporting fortune. It begins during the Troubles in a working class Catholic family in the Protestant town of Lisbon near Belfast. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, author of Boy on the Shed, Paul Ferris. Paul, good morning to you.
Morning, James. How are you?
I'm very well. Good to have you with us as well. Isn't it just always seems to strike me when you get a tricky winger from Northern Ireland, anybody coming out of that particular part of the world, they're described as the new George Best.
Yeah, and I actually, that's very true. I actually think I can't think of one before me. I think I was quite soon afterwards, and it's one of those labels that you get. But in reality, you're never going to be that, because there's only ever going to be one of him. So I think it's one of those things that you just take with a pinch of salt, I think.
Exactly. So tell me how it all sort of started. You know, you grew up in Northern Ireland, and like so many young, talented footballers, made the move over to the UK at an early age.
Yeah, I left. I actually was very young. I left school just after turning 16. So I actually was younger to seven kids. It was a big. My mum wasn't very well. It was a bit of a wrench for me to go, but I think, Jazz, what happened very quickly for me was the football on the Newcastle side went very well, and within 6 months I was playing in the first team, and I went home, played in the first team in the May, and I went home in the June, and my friends were sitting at O levels from school, so that gives you an idea of how young you are, really. But maybe, I believe, too young, really.
I mean, I don't know an awful lot about football in the province, but I do know the name Lisbon, and that was the team that you played for. So how were you picked up, and what was your childhood team? Was it Newcastle? Was it Manchester United or one of the other teams?
Oh, my childhood team was Liverpool, because I was a child of the 70s, and in the 70s Liverpool were winning everything. So Kevin Keegan was my first sort of boyhood hero, and amazingly, not long after I arrived at Newcastle, he arrived as a player, which was just a staggering thing to be. I think I described in the book, it was almost another worldly experience to sort of have this icon that you sort of just see in TV, and you know, 1 minute he's on TV, and the next minute he's sitting beside you as your teammate.
And so how were you picked up? How did the move
it was really interesting that sectarianism and religion played a big part in my life, and actually religion was a big part of the reason why I ended up coming to Newcastle. Lisbon was a big Protestant town, but we were a Catholic family, and there was a team at the time in Ireland called Linfield, who were a bit like Glasgow Rangers at that time. They didn't play Catholics. They had a policy of not playing Catholics, so the Linfield scout came to our home in Lisbon, presuming I was a Protestant boy, until he walked in the door and saw lots and lots of holy relics around the room, and realised that I couldn't go to Linfield. So he very kindly said, "Look, you can't sign for Linfield because we don't sign Catholics, but my friend is a scout at Newcastle United, and I think you're good enough to go there. So I'd like to get your trial organised." So actually, in a roundabout way, religion played a part in me leaving Ireland.
It kind of works in your favour then, getting a trial over at Newcastle.
It did. Yeah, it did. It absolutely did. And I'd been to Manchester United as a boy when I was 11. I was very homesick. I was a very shy boy, so I didn't want to stay there. And I'd been to Everton and been to Everton and had a chance to go there and didn't want to go. And Newcastle was the first city that really the people almost reminded me they were similar to the people that I'd grown up with in their ways and their manners, and I felt like it was the first time I felt like maybe I could go and stay in this part of the world.
I mean, the Geordies are an incredibly friendly bunch, aren't they?
Absolutely, I've made my life here now. I left home in 1981, and I'm still in Newcastle. I never left Newcastle, and my children are born here, and my wife's an Irish girl, but our life is here now.
For those, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Ireland has been in the news in one way or the other for the past sort of 12 months. What with what's going on with the Brexit thing, and I'm sorry to bring Brexit in during a football conversation, but a lot of people may, you know, especially millennials, don't remember what the province was like. I mean, we know Belfast now as a place of regeneration and a place that's you know, and the whole province has come on in leaps and bounds. But at that point, you know, writing about in the 70s and until you went to Newcastle in the 80s, it really was a different world.
Oh, it was a foreboding place. It was a, it was a, it was a, it was a, So I wasn't allowed, when I was a child growing up, I wasn't allowed to go into Belfast on a company. And when you did go in, you couldn't go, you just couldn't go shopping as a normal shopping street. Every single street had a barrier there with armed checkpoints and everything, you know. And the Northern Ireland that I grew up in was a very dark society, and some of it unfortunately touched on my family. And the biggest concern, I guess, and you raised Brexit, but the biggest concern for me is that the politicians and the current politicians have kind of got short memories and they've forgotten how bad it just was. And they just need, I almost think the Northern Irish border thing has almost come up and shocked everybody as to how significant it is that there can be no hard border there again, because if there is one and one goes back there again, it could very easily just slip back into something that we all think is gone forever, because it's the underlying tensions and things. I go home still, you know, that there are big cultural differences there, and that the Good Friday Agreement was a remarkable piece of legislation that actually allowed both parts of the community to feel like they were, now the Irish people to feel Irish and the unionist population to feel closer to Britain, if that's possible to be. So it was a remarkable piece of legislation that it should not be discarded lightly, I hope.
Let's get away from that one, but good points. Let's talk about the football and Newcastle United. What was it like when you walked onto the pitch and started training, or you started training and then walked onto the pitch for your first match at St James Park as the youngest first teamer they'd ever had?
Yeah, I mean, I tried really hard to describe it in the book, Judge, to try and give the reader a feeling of what it must feel like for any boy, because I think most boys have that dream, certainly most working class boys have that dream of being a professional footballer, and I can only say, I mean, walking on the pitch for the first time to play was one experience where your heart's thumping, your legs are like jelly, you're looking around the crowd thinking, am I really here? You know, is this possible? But actually scoring a goal at St James's Park, I tried to describe, was the most electrifying experience of my life. It was almost like someone just plugged you into your socket, because the noise, and you caused that noise. And I remember trying to catch my breath, and my friend ran across the pitch to me about 5 minutes after I scored and said, "Look, are you okay?" I said, "Not really. I can't breathe. I'm really, really." And I thought, it's just such an overwhelming experience, and one that I thought was going to happen again and again. But unfortunately, for me, it only happened once. But I suppose once is better than never.
And the people that you were playing with and were playing under, your manager was Jack Charlton, who is a legend, obviously, in the Republic.
Mm. Yeah, Jack was my manager when I scored my only goal for Newcastle United. But before Jack came along, obviously, I had the great privilege of playing with my boyhood hero. He was Kevin Keegan at the time, and then you've got people coming through who went on to become, I think, footballing legends, and Chris Waddle and Peter Beardsley and Paul Gascoigne, and you're just at that particular point you're training with them every day, and you don't see their profile outside. You just see them as teammates or colleagues who are very talented.
I mean, was there a terrific sense of camaraderie? Because, I mean, Beardsley, Waddle and Gascoigne were all North East boys as well, weren't they? So, I mean, that was their club.
Yeah, and Newcastle, I mean, the Newcastle that I joined probably was very different to what football is today. It was a very parochial club, and in some ways, a very, very, very Geordie identity. Most of the squad when I arrived were from Newcastle. There was three or four Irishmen there, which was a help to me, a couple of Welsh lads, and then one or two Scottish lads. But the majority of it was a Geordie. It was a Geordie culture with a very Geordie feeling. Actually, they'd just come out of the doldrums, really, and lots of old non-league players still hanging around there. So it was a very, very earthy culture, for want of a better term.
And I can't let this section of the interview go without saying, because everybody's got talks about Paul at Gascoigne and you know what a brilliant talent he was and what a troubled talent he is now. What was he like to play with and to hang around on a day-to-day basis?
He was a very, very, very lovable character, a very likable character, someone who always had a smile, always had a practical joke, always just everything was off the cuff. Even in any conversation with him, he never quite knew where I was going to go, or when you're on the pitch, you never quite knew where he was going to go. I've met him several times over the years, and it's a desperate, you know, he has an illness, and I hope he can find his way through it, because he's actually a man with an enormous heart, I think, how I would describe him.
You had all the beginnings and all the makings of a long career in football, at Newcastle United, but unfortunately it was cut short by injury. How does a young man cope with that sort of injury and the realisation that it wasn't an injury that ended your career full stop, but it was one that affected the rest of your career. And there's a passage in the book where you say that you stopped being a footballer, I think it's at 19, but you carried on playing football for another 10 years because you weren't at what you considered your best.
Yeah, I played until I was 25 and not in non-league football, but in reality, my ability was to be a fast and tricky winger, and that left with a knee injury when I was 19, and I tried to get fit for about 2 years at the football club, and I think I described myself in the room as sort of being in the room but just disappearing from the room. I knew it was going and I couldn't stop it, and actually very sadly after when the football career finished, my mum, who was ill my whole life, sadly passed away in it. And I think at that particular point, Jazz, if your mum has gone and your football career is gone, I think it's one of those moments in life when I look back now, it was definitely a sink or swim moment for me. And I actually found my way back through education. Not everybody would choose that route, but it just seemed the right place for me to go. I walked into the local college and asked, could I do some exams? And they said, well, you've got no qualifications. You've got to do these basic ones first. And eventually got myself a physiotherapy degree. And within 4 months of getting that degree, was back at Newcastle United as a physiotherapist, bizarrely.
And what's it like walking back then into St James Park and the whole setup? Because you presumably know the setup. There must be a feeling of the some comfort and the familiarity of being, rather than, you know, being pitching up at Blackburn Rovers with not knowing anybody there.
Oh, absolutely. It felt like, I mean, when I walked in the first day at the training ground, the manager was Kevin Keegan, and the physiotherapist was a man called Derek Wright, who was my physio when I was there, and there were still one or two players, sort of, Peter Beardsley was back there again. So it was, I wouldn't say it was like coming home, but it certainly felt very comfortable to walk back into it. And it was a, you know, when you slip out the back door of professional football, you don't think you're ever going to come back. So actually to come back in any capacity was a proud moment for me to come back. I felt, and at that particular point, I probably would have thought I would stay there for the rest of my career. But then managers change and circumstances change, and then life moves on. So I eventually left again.
This is one of the things that seems to be about me reading about you, Paul, and reading through the book, is the fact that it's like the Chumbawamba song. You get knocked down and you come back again, because you know, having got back from an injury and had that shadow, to come back and train and get your degree, and then you're back at Newcastle United, which is, let's call it, you know, the spiritual home, and then you're out again. And rather than go, oh well, I might as well go and run a pub somewhere, you retrain. Was it as a barrister this time around?
Yeah, I trained. I studied law while I was at the football club, and I actually, the barrister route was a really simple thing for me. When I was very young, I was incredibly shy. I probably don't sound it in this interview, but I couldn't find my voice. I had no voice, and I no matter what, I'd be in rooms with people, and I think, God, I wish I could stand up and speak. And the barrister thing was almost a challenge for myself to get over that and think, well, actually, if you're gonna go and do something, there can't be anything more scary than having to stand up in front of a judge who's probably got a brain the size of Britain. and then try and argue your point, and I genuinely thought that was going to be my career, and that was a tough, you know, it was a really tough journey to go and try and be and my wife let me sell half of our home and go to bar school, and then to get pupillage in this country is really difficult, and I managed to get that, and I was practicing criminal law in Leeds as a pupil barrister when again football came back into my life, and Alan Shearer called me up and said, I'm taking over it. At that time, Southampton Football Club, would you like to run the sports medicine, sports science department? And I kind of paused for a second and said, but I'm a barrister now. And he said, but, you know, I was always going to ask you. I said, couldn't you have asked before I sold half my home? And he said, well, I'll come and listen to what these people say. And, to cut a very long story short, I was flattered that Alan, of all the people he met in football, thought that I might be the person to help him on his journey to be a manager. And it didn't seem like a gamble. It seemed like he was going to be a manager for me, and I was going to be the quiet man by his side, but obviously that didn't work out.
I mean, it's the casual way that you mention names that for many of us are heroes: Rude Hullett, Paul Gascoigne, Peter Beardsley, Chris Waller, and Alan Shearer. And Alan's written the foreword to your book, and going through the foreword of the book, it strikes me that he is an incredibly intelligent, but also a guy who's very perceptive and obviously cares. You know, you call this international superstar. Remember, he was the highest paid player, wasn't he? £15 million when he moved. He's obviously a very good friend.
He is, and has been for many years. Just through, I met him. I think he talked about it in the foreword. I think I met him on the day he arrived, and he was a superstar at that particular point. And I actually met him, and we did the medical, and he and I went and sat and had a cup of tea and had some biscuits while the rest of his contract was being sorted out. And we sat for an hour and had a chat. And I phoned my wife on the way. I just talked to my wife afterwards, and I just said, look, forget the football a bit. I think this lad's going to be my friend. I just have a connection with him. And then he got a couple of really, really, really nasty injuries. And interesting, as you mentioned Chumbawamba, he will thank me for that. I think I did put it in the book. He used to sing Chumbawamba, "I get knocked down, but I get up again." He's quite a loud character. So that's actually in the book. But I spent an awful lot of time with him. I still do. The company that I work for and I run now, he's a director of the company, and he's one of my friends. It sounds like a terrible name drop, so I'm always looking to do it. But he's been a great friend to me through good and bad.
And I mean, because Alan became manager, you got involved with the team. I won't tell you. I mean, it's quick history what happened. But how do you again pick yourself up again when this is again, you know, the team that you have played for? You've been the sports physio. You've been an important part of this management team, and then suddenly, literally like that, it's gone.
Yeah, that was a. I think I tried again to try to condemn it, but that was a particularly dark period because I felt like I'd perhaps let my family down at that particular point and took us on a journey that may have led us to financial ruin, among other things. But I actually wrote a novel to try and pass the time, and as a novel that not many people have ever read. It was called An Irish Heartbeat, and I never got a proper publisher. And I sort of sat around waiting for Alan to get a job, and he got offered many jobs. And you know, and he'd come to me and we'd talk about it, and he'd say, "Oh, it's not right for this reason, it's not right for that reason." But in reality, at that particular point, I'm running out of money. But I can't really say to him, "Can you take a job? Because I need the money." It's his career as well. So I found myself at his birthday party, his 40th birthday party, standing beside a man called Graham Wiley, who's a very well known businessman in the Northeast. He was responsible for writing Sage Pay when he was 22 years old, and he's a multimillionaire in his own right, and he basically said, "Like, would you consider going to America and have a look at a piece of medical equipment for me with your background and give me an opinion?" And I was doing nothing else, so that's what I did. I came back and told him what I thought of it, and he said, "If you feel that passionate, give me 1 year of your life." And that was 6-7 years ago now, and I'm now the chief executive of a hopefully a successful health and fitness company. But then right in the middle of all that, I had a heart attack. I had a heart attack as I was making my way again. So the heart attack was the germ of the book, really. The heart attack was the beginning of the book, because it made me sit and stop in my tracks. And if you have a heart attack at 48 years old, it does stop everything for the moment.
So what was it like then? I mean, how did you start? And why did you just decide to? Because, I mean, it's on the long list for the William Hill Book of the Year. Henry Winter, the well-known sports journalist, said it's one of the most talked-about football books of last year. The great Simon Mayo, who I'm a huge fan of, said it's going to be Sports Book of the Year. What a life, what a book. I mean, did you expect, when you set out to write this memoir, that it would be so lauded?
Well, when I set out to write it, I expected that the only people who would read it would be my children and their children, possibly. And it was a record of who their dad was and who their mum was and how we ended up living in Newcastle. But I very quickly picked up, once a publisher, I mean, Hodder picked it up, and a huge publisher picked it up, and an outstanding editor, and Roddy Bloomfield, who's published thousands of books, picked it up. Once they started talking about it and what they felt it was, I sort of had a feeling that it was going to be quite good, but I always have difficulty in believing those things. So right now, as we speak, the book is the Sunday Times, which is amazing for me. The book is the Sunday Times Sports Book of the Year, it's the Times Sports Book of the Year, it's the Daily Telegraph Football Book of the Year, and it's shortlisted for the William Hills Sports Book. So it's done amazingly well and beyond anything I could ever hope for, really.
You couldn't have done all of this, of course, without the support of your childhood sweetheart. And I know that's a cliche in terms, but your wife Geraldine has obviously been there for you as well.
Well, she's very, very sadly, just after Christmas, she lost her father, and that's the first time in our life together, where actually I feel like I've had to actually almost support. I feel like she's supported me all of my life because I lost my parents young, and we met. It does sound in the modern times really strange, but we met when she was 13 and I was 14, and she shared it. She shared my life's journey with me, and I hope there's more in it too. Because if I had two lives to share, I'd share them alone with her personally. That sounds a bit soppy, but that's how I feel about it.
Do you think you've been particularly sort of lucky that you were playing football at that time, like late 70s, early 80s? Because you said it is a different time, a different atmosphere in clubs. And now with players with huge salaries, all on the social media, all media managed, perhaps you were able to have a bit more fun, and it was a bit more communication with the fans.
Oh, I think football's lost. I don't doubt for a second that football at the highest level's lost its connection, and for want of a better term, lost its soul in terms of what it meant to communities and even Newcastle United it's a completely different animal to what it was when I was here. There's two sides of that, Jai. One bit about playing in the first team now at 16. They would have had to give me a contract that would have probably given them family security for the rest of our lives, instead of in my case, I slipped out the back door and found myself signing on the dole 2 weeks later, which I don't recommend for anyone to go through, really. But no, you're quite right. Modern football at the highest level, I definitely think it's lost its way, and I do think it needs a reboot. But.
So, what do you hope that people get out of the book? You said you wrote it so say your children, your grandchildren would know sort of where you came from, etc. But what do you hope that people who read the book, The Boy in the Shed, can take away from it?
For me, it's a story about life. It's not a football. I hope anyone listening that is interested in the book, there is my life was involved in football. So there is football in there, but I didn't set out to write a football book. I set out to write a book about life and love and loss and leaving home and overcoming obstacles and maybe sometimes making the wrong decision, but trying to find another way if you have made the wrong decision. And it's just anyone who's interested in life and family and love would connect with the book.
The book is called The Boy on the Shed. It's by Paul Ferris. It's out now with Hodder and Stroughton. Paul, if people want to find out more about you or buy the book, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing? I just mentioned it before, but do you do the social media thing? Is there a website? How can people get hold of you or get hold of the book?
Yeah, I don't do the social media thing. But the book is very readily available on Amazon, who've done a great job with it. And so anyone who's got any connect to Amazon, you'll get it from there. And if you're across in the UK, Waterstones or as people would say, in all good bookstores are selling it here as well. So it's just come out on paperback last week, so you can get it a bit cheaply now than the hardback. But the hardback did remarkably well, and I hope the paperback does too.
Oh, and I'm holding a copy in my hot little hands as well. It's absolutely superb. There's some great pictures in it as well. And also, you can download it on the TRE Virtual Bookshop. Only leaves this to me to ask you, Paul. After this, barrister, footballer, physio, all the things you've done. What's up next for Paul Ferris?
Well, I'm going to try and continue along with my company and make it as big a success as we can. But more importantly, I'm going to continue with my writing and make that as big a success as I can. Once you write and you get that buzz from it, it's very hard to stop.
Indeed. The book is called The Boy on the Shed. It's by Paul Ferris. It's out now on Hodden and Stone, in hardback and in paperback too. Paul Ferris, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you, Jazz.